Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how have our ancestors dealt with earlier changes in their climate and environment, and what does it tell us about our current situation? And first, how one man infiltrated the Nazi cells and foiled their plots to sow chaos in Los Angeles. Stephen Ross is with us now. He is a professor of history at the University of Southern California. His latest book is Hitler in Los Angeles. So welcome back to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you, Stephen Ross.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
I was reading your book, and you opened with a quote from Hitler in the prologue about how to take power in the USA. And he essentially said it was to undermine the people's morale and faith in the government and sow confusion. Now, it seems like that's what was the effort at the time that you've been researching Hitler in Los Angeles, but it also seems like there's some parallels today, don't you think?
Yeah, well, the only difference is the end part of that quote that you didn't read was that this was to sow dissension in preparation for taking over the government. We now have people sowing hate on the streets of the United States, not for the purpose of taking over the government, but of sort of, in a sense, reasserting white superiority at a time when they know they are on the losing end of history.
Right, but the idea of sowing confusion in the government is something that other governments overseas do try to do, sowing confusion in this way.
Right, the only problem is right now our own government is sowing confusion amongst its people. It doesn't need a foreign government to come in and do that for them.
Right. So why was Joseph Goebbels focused on Los Angeles?
Well, there are two answers to that. One is why Goebbels was focused on Los Angeles, and the second one is why were the Nazis in general focused on Los Angeles? And for Goebbels, it was because he and Hitler both loved movies. They both watched them regularly. They loved Hollywood films in general, and particularly Walt Disney films. And they felt that had it not been for the propaganda machine coming out of Hollywood and British cinema during World War I, that Germany could have swayed a lot more of world opinion to its side. And when Hitler came into power in 1933, he immediately appointed Goebbels as his Reich Minister of Enlightenment and Propaganda, an odd combination. And Goebbels decided that they were going to make sure that Hollywood would not do this again. And so he sent to Los Angeles in June 1933 German consul George Gisling with one mission, and that is to prevent the studios from making any film that attacked, denigrated, mocked Hitler or Nazi Germany. And the power he had was something called Article 15 of a German import law from a few years before that said that the German government had the power to ban any film or even nation if its films denigrated in any way the Nazis, the German government and people. And so Hollywood moguls went along thinking two things. One, that, well, Hitler isn't going to really be in power that long. You know, he rose there, you know, with his anti-Semitism, but he's going to calm down, and either he'll calm down or be out of power. And the other feeling was, in the meantime, we have to stay in the German market, which is our second most profitable market in Europe, next to Great Britain. And so Goebbels got his man on the job, and he did the job. And that was all. He was also aided because a year later, Hollywood passed the production code that also contained a clause saying you can't mock or attack a foreign government. And so we had even though many studios wanted to produce anti-Nazi movies starting in 1933, none of them could because they wouldn't get a seal of approval from the production code administration. And so we didn't get our first anti-Nazi movie until April 1939. It's a long time. And Goebbels' arm reached for a long time across the ocean and into Hollywood.
Fascinating. You know, simultaneously, you noted that in Los Angeles and Southern California in general, there was historic anti-Semitism. So it was already a bit of a hotbed. Would you say there was a sense of, like, already a community that Goebbels and Hitler could reach out to?
Oh, yes. This was a Southern California, particularly south of Los Angeles, but Los Angeles as well, was a hotbed of reactionary activity. Long Beach was a major center for Ku Klux Klan, as was Orange County. By the 1920s, polite society in Los Angeles was progressively excluding Jews from various clubs and even limiting their participation in the Chamber of Commerce. And you had a anywhere from a polite to open anti-Semitism in L.A. and Southern California. The other thing that the German government understood is that even though New York was the kind of center of Jewish America, it was also overseen by Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia, who is half Jewish. And LaGuardia was a strong anti-Nazi, and he made sure that the ports of New York were closely guarded against any kind of Nazi efforts to smuggle in people, propaganda, money, orders. And so they started shipping everything to Los Angeles. And in my book, I talk about the spy ring that was started by Leon Lewis, and his spies managed to become right-hand men to the Nazi leaders, and they went down to the docks and saw them exchanging money, orders, packages with the either the ship captain or the Gestapo officer on the ship. And so L.A. became spy central for Germany, sending through its own sort of espionage and sabotage.
Well, let's back up a little, because I think that this is the main point of the book, Hitler in Los Angeles, which is that Leon Lewis organized these spies to find out what these Nazi groups were doing so that he could try to circumvent their efforts. So how big were these cells, for lack of a better term, of these Nazi groups?
Probably at their peak several hundred. But you need to remember that a number of these people were devoted Nazis who were drilling with weaponry on a regular basis, practicing armed combat, and particularly practicing urban armed combat. And the Nazis had announced that they were going to, one day, the communists were going to rise up against the American government. And on that day, the Nazis would be the group that would lead Americans to, you know, kill the communists and stop the threat to American democracy. At least that's what they said to everyone. So, you know, you had a hardcore that were committed to doing whatever it took to basically, in America, preach anti-Semitism and to prepare for the day that Hitler would invade the United States.
And Leon Lewis, let's talk about him as a leader. At the time, you noted that people were protesting and boycotting, but he thought that these were not really all that useful, so he wanted to do something more practical. Tell us more about Leon Lewis.
Well, Leon Lewis was born in the 1880s in Wisconsin and wound up going to university and then law school at University of Chicago. And when he graduated in 1913, he became one of the three founding members of the Anti-Defamation League in Chicago. And he served as their first executive secretary until he left to serve in World War One. And when he came back from service, he told the other executives there that they needed to start monitoring anti-Semitism abroad. And so he took on a second hat as the executive secretary of the international division of the ADL. And he moved to L.A. in 1930-31 and opened his own law practice here. And that's what he expected to do for the rest of his life. But when Nazis held their first open meeting in Los Angeles at the end of July 1933 and announced that, you know, their intention was to rid the country of communists and Jews, who they thought were one and the same, Lewis said, that's enough talk. We now need to swing into action. And so he went to his local post of the Disabled American Veterans and he began by recruiting four World War I veterans and their wives, all of whom agreed to go undercover and join every Nazi and fascist group in Los Angeles and try to rise to positions of power, and then send back daily reports on what they discovered. And once they did, within a few weeks, they sent him back reports about an attempt to seize armories in San Francisco, L.A., and San Diego by Nazis, Nazi plot to seize the armories, and on a specific day, there would be an uprising. Nazi troops, both from boats and from the Friends of New Germany, would storm the armories, take over the arms. They would ask any soldier who wanted to join them to do so, and anyone who refused, they would shoot on the spot. When Leon Lewis heard this, he went immediately to the chief of police in Los Angeles, James Davis, and he started telling him about this, and Davis stopped him and said, you know, you got it all wrong. Hitler's got it right. He's only doing what he needs to do to fix the German economy, because the Jews have proven such a problem in Germany. And in fact, the real problem in Los Angeles isn't with the Nazis, it's with all those communists in Boyle Heights, which was the Jewish neighborhood of L.A. at the time. And as far as the captain was concerned, he let Leon Lewis know that every communist was a Jew and every Jew was a communist. And when he went to the sheriff's department, he was also rebuffed. And when he went to the FBI, he was told there's nothing we can do unless we give orders from Washington, D.C. And so it was at that point that Leon Lewis realized that American government officials were so obsessed with finding communists that they didn't give a damn about Nazis and fascists, and that he never intended to be a spy master, but he had to do it because no one else was paying attention. And he kept doing it until the end of World War II.
Obviously, these are dangerous missions, and they had to be really well thought out. And the ways in which he thought out how each of these spies could get admitted into the groups, and then there were times when they were questioned, their loyalty was questioned. There was always the risk, of course, of getting co-opted. So these are dangerous missions. Lewis himself was under constant threat of retaliation, right?
Right.
Now, at what point did the Nazi groups know about Leon Lewis? And how much did they know about him?
Well, I think they knew within 3 months that Leon Lewis was running some kind of undercover operation. And they knew it for sure within the first year. They just didn't know who any of his spies were, and they never did. And they dubbed him the most dangerous Jew in Los Angeles. And it's interesting that they tried to kidnap his children at one point, but they never tried to assassinate Leon Lewis.
So it was dangerous for him. And there were times when they challenged the loyalty of some of the spies, like Schmidt, for example.
Right. Well, let's put it this way. Over the course of his spying operation, from 1933 until 1943, three of his spies died under highly suspicious circumstances. And I'm convinced two of them were either killed or Nazi sympathizers were complicit in the death of two of the three spies.
So they were discovered at some point, or at least
suspected. Well, they were, mainly because his first four spies, were three Christians and one Jew. And in fact, almost all his spies were Christians. And he had the three Christian spies testify at a trial. And once they did that, they were both known to the German community and under danger. And John Schmidt, the first of the spies who was German-born, at the trial they came over to him and kept telling him that he was a dead man. He was a dead man. And that they were going to kill him for betraying his country. So these were very courageous people because they knew that the Nazis would at some point carry out their threat.
You know, some of the plans, like you talked about the overthrow of the U.S. government via uprisings to spark violence, did they have a comprehensive plan for this?
Not really. Yes and no. They had the outlines and blueprints, because in my book I talk about various national leaders forging a kind of united front of fascists and Nazis in America in major cities around the country. And while they never had a single line of communication saying, we're going to do this and this on the same day, they were all preparing for the day in which one of them would actually start a series of pogroms, and then that would inspire the others to take up arms and just start massacring Jews in every major city. And they talked about that. They talked about turning the major cities of America into a Jewish bloodbath. But no one ever coordinated a national response. They did have local plots, though. And in the case of L.A., those plots never happened because Leon Lewis's spies were able to foil them time and time again.
And were they generally plots like the one that he foiled related to the Bay Area?
They were much more sinister. There were two plots to... They knew that Hollywood and Los Angeles were synonymous. And if you wanted to get world's attention, if you had killing of Jews in Portland, no one was going to care. If you had the killing of Jews in New Jersey, no one was going to care. And even in New York, which the Nazis referred to as Jew York, no one was going to care. But if you murdered Hollywood moguls and movie stars, the whole world would pay attention. And so there were two plots in two successive years, one of which they were going to hang 20 Jews, Hollywood figures as well as political figures, and then they would shoot their bodies, as they put it, full of lead after they were dangling on the rope. And they believed that this would send a worldwide message and lead to pogroms. But that got foiled by one of Lewis's ace spies, Chuck Slocum, who persuaded the plotters that Leon Lewis had an agent inside and that if they went ahead and did this, they would be caught and tried for murder. And so they decided to postpone it until they could figure out who the spy was, which they never did. And in a second instance that was even more shocking, it was a British fascist, Leopold McLaughlin, who had been at one point the world's jiu-jitsu champion and had taught jiu-jitsu and arm-to-arm combat to Scotland Yard in the Sûreté, came to Los Angeles in the late in 1937 and organized a plot to kill 24 Hollywood figures. And in this case, it was going to be all producers and movie stars and two movie stars who were Christian but too sympathetic to the Jews, Charlie Chaplin and James Cagney. And they were convinced that if you hung 24, rather they were going to blow up the homes of these 24 people on the same night, that you bet they were right. That would have gotten the whole world to pay attention, and they believed it would have emboldened everyone in America, every anti-Semite, to take action against the Jewish problem. And again, that was foiled by Leon Lewis's ace spy, Chuck Slocum.
Now, simultaneously, some of the people in these Nazi groups were infiltrating Hollywood companies, right?
Right. I mean, that's one of the interesting discoveries I made, is that the undercover agents found that, you know, the studio heads were paying attention to what we call above-the-line personnel. That is, the names that appear at the beginning of a movie, when you go in and you see the credits roll. So it'll be the movie stars, the writer, the director, the producers. And then at the very end of the movie, when they have all the craftsmen and the workers from the film, the general workers, that's referred to as below the line. Well, the studio chiefs were not paying attention to the below the line, and Leon Lewis's spies discovered that many of the studio foremen who did the hiring and firing were members, either pro-Nazi or members of their American equivalent, the Silver Shirts, and that they were firing every Jewish craft worker in the studios. In some places, like Paramount, had reached almost 100%, quote, Aryan employees and below the line. And even Louis B. Mayer, the sort of biggest Jew of them all, his studio MGM had been penetrated by the Silver Shirts, including the head of the L.A. Silver Shirts, and he had no idea.
So Leon Lewis then was able to go to some of the big Hollywood executives and moguls and finally get them to understand what was happening, right?
Right. More than get them to understand it, he had a secret meeting at Hillcrest Country Club, which had been founded by Jews after they discovered they were excluded from every country club in L.A. because they were Jews. So they opened their own club and ironically struck oil within a short amount of time. But they came, 40 of the major Hollywood leaders, mostly studio chiefs and the number two and three people, and a few other producers, directors, had a secret meeting where Leon Lewis told them everything that was going on, and in fact how Nazis and silver shirts were in their studios and how they were in danger. And by the end of the evening, the moguls had agreed, even though they were publicly doing business with Germany, they hated having to do so. And when they found out Nazis were in their studio, they went crazy, and they underwrote Lewis's entire operation for the rest of the for the duration of his spy operation.
Some of the other things I thought were really notable, not so much necessarily in telling of the story, but in the context of what was going on at the time. You mentioned in the book that because they were cutting pensions for veterans, that it actually fueled the sort of Nazi movement. How did that all work?
Well, what the Nazis did, when the Nazis opened up their first meeting in Los Angeles in July 1933, their aim was to follow the same strategy that Hitler had done in the 1920s when he recruited his brown shirts. And that is, he recruited them amongst military veterans who were really upset because the German government had cut their benefits. And they felt like, here we were patriots, we went to war, and now that we've come back, no one cares about us. We've been thrown on the, you know, the trash heap of history. And many of them were very angry, and they were looking for answers and looking for scapegoats. And Hitler came along and said, I can save you. I can make Germany great again. You know, I can answer all your problems, and only I can do this. And the first thing we're going to do is, you know, get rid of the Jews from power. They've really screwed our country over. And so he had sent in March a military veteran from Germany, Captain Robert Pape, to organize, you know, essentially an American brown shirt army. And that's why they were so interested in John Schmidt and the first four of Leon Lewis's spies, because they were hoping if these people would be sympathetic to them, they would recruit former American veterans who in turn could both recruit and teach other Americans, drill them in military tactics, and they could raise an army that would be ready to support Hitler's forces in America at any moment.
Now, do you know if the groups at the time, the Nazi groups at the time, had any connection to what we currently still see with the white supremacy groups or the KKK or any of those? Were they interconnected?
Yes, they were, actually. They were independent by and large, but by the mid-30s, they created in Los Angeles a United Fascist Front that had representatives from each of these organizations talking about common strategies and common plotting and raising money amongst a common array of people who they thought would be sympathetic and would give money to all of them, in particular if they could show how powerful the fascist movement was. And the other thing is you had cross-membership. People in the Klan also belonged to groups like the American Rangers. You had some members of the Friends of New Germany that later became the German-American Bund, who belonged to the Silver Shirts. So you had cross-pollination of fascist groups in the city and across the country.
So toward the end, how many Nazis from these groups ended up in jail as a result of Lewis's spy network?
Well, there were quite a few arrested and detained right after Pearl Harbor, certainly in the 90s, low hundreds. Many others put under surveillance. A number of them remained jail for weeks or a few months. But in terms of long-term prison sentences, only two remained in prison, and that is Hermann Schwinn, who was the head of the Bund in Los Angeles and also known as the Gauleiter for the Western District, meaning he was the head Nazi for all Bund chapters in the Western United States, and his number one man, Hans Deibel. They were put in jail on December 8th, and Deibel was not released until around 1946, and Hermann Schwinn was not released until around 1947, and he was then sent to Argentina.
So were these related to the sedition trial?
Yes, they were. These many of the Nazis and fascists were put on trial multiple times, and finally the 1944 trial was called the Great Sedition Trial, because in a number of cases they had urged young Americans of draft age not to enter the draft if we were drafted, and in fact to openly oppose it if we went into war. And they were doing it even after Pearl Harbor, and so a number of them were arrested for sedition, put on trial, and eventually the charges were thrown out, mainly because the judge died, and then they discovered the case wasn't strong enough, and by that time, it was the beginnings of the Cold War, and nobody cared about Nazis. They were all focusing on Reds.
So your book comes out as we've been seeing sort of a rise in white supremacism, these emboldened marches, and evidence of at least one other country seeming to try to affect American democratic processes. I wonder two things. One is, what can we learn from history that we can bring forward today?
Well, I would say the big lesson of the book is that when hate groups move from the margins to the mainstream, and when government authorities seem either complacent or complicit, it's up to every American to stand up and basically stand up against hate. And whether it's gestures large or small, you know, you hear somebody making hate speech, stop them. Say something. There's a demonstration against these groups, go. Be there. Be peaceful. But make sure that they know this is not okay, that this is not normal, that in fact, you know, hate festers if no one speaks up.
You know, one of the other points that was early on in the book had to do with when people were trying to organize in opposition to the Nazi groups, they couldn't come to any agreement about what needed to be done. And so groups, they splintered and were therefore ineffective.
Yes, and that's why one of the things I learned, and I sort of wrote in the prologue that I had also believed, you know, this idea that Jews didn't, in America, didn't do enough to stop Hitler, and that they were passive in the wake of Nazism. And that's entirely wrong. Jews, as you point out, had a divided strategy. And the division was basically, do we get in Hitler's face through an international boycott of German goods and just keep making it tighter and tighter and hurt the German economy? Or do we work behind the scenes and try to get German religious leaders to pressure Hitler? Because that group that wanted to work behind the scenes said, if you get in Hitler's face, he's going to double down and make it worse for the Jews. And the aggressive group said, well, nothing's going to happen if we take your path. And so they could never quite agree. And it was really only after Kristallnacht in November 1938 that they began cooperating more. What I also realized is that, once again, to blame Jewish groups in America for being complacent, which is not true, but even to say, well, you never even came together until it was too late, seems to me is blaming the victim sort of analogy, when really the question to ask is, why did the American government remain so complacent, oblivious, and in many cases supportive of Nazis and fascists? And what I saw in Los Angeles, tremendous amount of anti-Semitism within government officials, including the head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, who was so obsessed with tracking down Reds that he didn't order, despite his own local agent saying, you got to put Hermann Schwinn, the number two Nazi in America, under surveillance. Hoover didn't order it until the middle of November 1941, less than a month away from Pearl Harbor. So if there's any blame, it should be upon the head of American government and not upon the head of American Jews.
And it seemed like while there was not support for Lewis and his efforts initially, he did eventually find support in the administration. Isn't that right?
Well, not in the administration per se, but there were people who would listen. They started, he and his associate, Spymaster Joe Roos, started putting out a news research letter in 1939. And that was sent to a lot of government officials, and they would take a lot of their spy material and turn it into articles without revealing any information that people could use to identify their spies. But the other thing they were doing, particularly at the beginning of World War II, they were compiling lists of all suspicious Nazis, Italian fascists, and to a lesser extent even Japanese fascists. And they were mailing those lists on a regular basis to Army intelligence, Naval intelligence, and the FBI. You know, the interesting question I had to ask myself is, you know, after Pearl Harbor, the FBI in Los Angeles was widely praised for rounding up the Nazis and fascists so quickly. And I said to myself, how's that possible if they didn't even have them under surveillance? And the answer is they used the lists that Leon Lewis and Joe Roos had sent them. And I found those lists in the National Archives. And both the Army, the Navy, and the FBI just retyped those lists with the same information Lewis had given them. And in fact, Joe Roos had divided them into three categories: most dangerous, keep under surveillance, and watch out for. And the Attorney General sent the list to Los Angeles FBI, and instead of calling them that, he called it Group A, B, and C, and said go after Group A first. And they were all people from Lewis and Roos's list. So it was these two Jews running an undercover spy ring that, in a sense, saved the city from disaster and helped the FBI round up the suspects after Pearl Harbor.
So the difference that one or two people can really make in this.
That's right, and that's what I mean. And the interesting thing is Leon Lewis, Joe Roos, and their spies, they never fired a weapon. They used the most powerful weapon of all, their brain. And they did it in a non-violent, non-confrontational way, and they essentially defeated their enemy without much help from the government.
Well, Stephen Ross, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for sharing your research with us.
Well, thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
Stephen Ross is a professor of history at the University of Southern California. His latest book is Hitler in Los Angeles. When we come back, how have our ancestors dealt with earlier changes in their climate and environment? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How have our ancestors dealt with earlier changes in their climate and environment, and what does it tell us about our current situation? With us is Simon Holdaway. He is a professor of anthropology at the University of Auckland, where he also serves as the head of School of Social Sciences. Simon Holdaway is the author of a number of publications, including A Record in Stone, and his more recent one, Geoarchaeology in Aboriginal Landscape in Semi-Arid Australia. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Simon Holdaway. It's great to have you here with us.
Thanks. Great to be here.
You've got three primary areas that you've been digging, essentially. Egypt, Australia, New Zealand. Are there reasons why you've chosen these three that seem like they would be disparate? Or is there some common theme that you're looking for?
It's a really interesting question, because if you look at archaeologists worldwide, they often really specialize in one area. certainly a temporal area, that's a time period, but often a geographic one too. So people will look at, for instance, the Yucatan area, the Mayan people, and at complex civilizations, so recent times. Other people are really interested in hominin ancestors, right? So the Paleolithic. So I guess I'm a little bit unusual because I've moved around the world and looked at people from different geographic areas, as you say, Australia, New Zealand, and Egypt. And I guess the reason is that I'm really interested in certainly the history of the peoples that I study, but I'm also interested in a comparative perspective to try and understand human cultural evolution on the bigger world stage, really, I guess, to do a lot of comparative work, to realise there's a lot of variation in the histories of different peoples around the world.
Well, good. That's exactly where I wanted you to go. So thank you for going there already. What are the comparison contrasts that you can draw from these three very old people, really? The big major differences that you find, as well as the common ground that you're finding.
Similarities. I think it's a little bit of a comment on our way of understanding human past in general. If we look at really coming out of the later 19th century, is this notion that people moved through kind of stages. So we had a hunter-gatherer stage, so people who hunted wild animals and used wild plants, right? And then there was the what people have described as a revolution, the Neolithic revolution, a sudden change with the arrival of domesticates. And then there's another later evolution, the urban evolution, as people start to concentrate into nucleated settlements, what we call villages or towns. And that's an idea that's been around for quite a long time. It really dominates still many of the textbooks in archaeology. But a number of us over the years, a number of colleagues really have started to dismantle, I guess, this notion of sudden and uniform changes. And I really emphasize this uniform notion that all peoples around the world somehow went through this series of stages from one to the other. And it's kind of linked to this notion of progression. So in other words, people who were hunter-gatherers had not yet progressed up to the level of the Neolithic, the term that we use to describe people with domesticated plants and animals. So much of my interest really is to take apart this notion of a fixed progression, indeed to take apart the notion of regression at all, and to understand the variability that there is in the way that people, humans in the past, have interacted both with themselves and with the environments they live in.
And so if we were going to take these three primary places where you've been doing your work, what would you say the differences were in those three? Australia, New Zealand, and Egypt.
I guess sort of intellectually what I've done is to start off in Australia, because I worked for a time at La Trobe University in Melbourne before I moved to Auckland. And my work in Australia was looking at relatively recent Aboriginal people. So the archaeology of relatively recent people last 6,000 years or so, because Australia has a long, long history of human involvement. And I was really, really interested in trying to understand the use of space, so how people distributed themselves across the landscape. And Aboriginal people made use of wild resources. They were, I guess, hunter-gatherers. They didn't have domestic plants and animals. They had the dog, but no other domesticated plants and animals. So they had a particular, I guess, life way. They moved a lot. And we were very, very interested in how people moved across the landscape, trying to get rid of this notion, I guess, that all of existence revolved around a place. And the analogy I use, I guess, is that we go from place to place. So we go from home to work, right? And our interest is in living in our house, our home, and then we get in some vehicle often and we drive frantically, or I cycle frantically to work, and then I'm at work. And so that passage from home to work is something that we kind of do as rapidly and as easily as possible. We don't think about it as a major part of our day. Our major parts of our day are at, if you like, nodes, places in the landscape. And what we've discovered, I really researched a whole lot in Australia, is that perhaps aspects of Aboriginal people's life was not like that. Much of life occurred during the journey rather than necessarily at the place. Certainly the sort of places that we find archaeological materials preserved. So we kind of changed this notion of node to node to think about movement as part of life, that moving through country was very important. And the Egypt project was interesting because we took whole series of different approaches, different methods that we developed in Australia, and we applied them in Egypt. And The interesting part about Egypt is that we had certainly a record of hunter-gatherers initially. The chronology is a little bit longer, and the material that I've looked at goes back to about 10,000 years ago through to about 6,000 years ago. But at the kind of end of that period, the people that we're studying, the remains of the people that we're studying, they adopted some domesticated plants and animals from Southwest Asia. So sheep, goat, a little bit of pig, wheat and barley. And what we did is to, I guess, use a different approach. People had seen the arrival of those domesticates as very much an important development, one of those kind of revolutions that I talked about before. And we approached it slightly differently, and we said, well, that's interesting, but I wonder if we put an Australian kind of perspective onto Egypt and look more at the level of movement around the landscape. Can we detect that? And we've got some techniques that let us look at that.
Just stop right there, mm-hmm. because I'd like to know about the techniques. What are the techniques?
Well, the techniques make use of material that we find archaeologically. And we need to remember that archaeological material is the material that survives. So archaeologists look at a lot of quite unusual things. They look kind of other people's rubbish, but particular forms of rubbish, the rubbish that tends to survive. It's made out of materials that survive. So I spend a lot of time, for instance, looking at stone artifacts along with my colleagues. And stone's a kind of wonderful medium because people used it in a world without metals, for instance, without plastic. You need something to cut things up and to scrape things and to manipulate other materials. And stone's a great medium for doing that. And it was very, very important for people for a very long time. But for archaeology, I guess the fantastic thing is not only was it important for people in the past, but it also survives. Reasonably difficult to destroy stone material, often survives in archaeological materials. The other great thing for us about stone is that it's a nice hard medium that people work by flaking, so they strike the stone to remove flakes. And in doing that, they change the kind of geometry of the stone. They take material gradually away. That changes both the volume of the material that's left and the surface area. The useful aspect to that process for us is that we can geometrically describe volume and surface. And the measurements that we make today, of course, reflect the geometry of the stone in the past directly. We can pretty much safely assume that the size of material that we see today was the same size that we saw in the past. It's this notion of a uniformitarian process. So we can use geometry to talk about the amount of material that should have been present, given the size of the rocks that are worked, and the amount of material that actually is present. And we can see that material has been moved away. So that gives us a quantifiable measure of movement. And we've used that a whole lot to understand how people use landscape.
When you say that it quantifies movement, the change in the geometry of the stone itself or where you find them?
The combination, actually. So one can imagine a block of stone. If you strike the block of stone, you take off a flake. If you remove that flake, then the size of the block of stone has reduced. And if you can estimate the size that originally was, the level of size change gives you a notion of how much material has been moved away. And of course, where the different material is that you find can be used
to where people have been.
Right. And right. That gives us a notion of movement. So we can actually quantify how much material is moving around, and from that make inferences about mobility. So that's just one example of the way that we've gone about understanding how people use a landscape.
And so now back to this idea of applying what you found in Australia with mobility to your dig in Egypt. What did you find?
I guess the interesting thing, it's a little bit like the analogy I was using about living in a home and going to work. With the development of domesticated plants and animals, people imagined, and there is indeed quite good evidence in other areas of Southwest Asia, so the Levant, for instance, that people lived in villages. So they lived in these beginning of a kind of nucleated settlement. And that's a form of settlement that perhaps strikes a chord with many of us because we live in villages, towns, cities, right? And again, we come back to this notion, well, we live in a nucleated place and we go to another place to do a set of task work, for instance, right? And we can imagine that the beginnings of an animal domestication is a little bit like that, right? So people began to live in villages, and they certainly did do that in some parts of the world, but interestingly, not all parts of the world. So when we looked at the Egyptian material, what we saw was certainly the appearance of domesticated plants and animals occur, but it seems not to have such a very big effect on both overall economy, the people that from 10,000 years ago are using a lot of fish, and in fact they continue to use a lot of fish from the Nile and a big lake that is fed by the Nile, Lake Karoon, that we've been studying. And that continues even though domesticated plants and animals arrive, and they don't seem to change their movement all that much either. In fact, they don't seem to develop the sort of villages that we expect. And a lot of people have suggested, well, almost on the presence of domesticated plants and animals alone, that they must have had villages. So what we did is to look at a number of locations, large number of locations across the landscape, use some of the techniques like I described with stone artifacts to look at movement and say, well, actually, we don't find any evidence for these villages. And I think what that illustrates is that the wonderful thing about human past is the variability. We all are not the same. We have variations in the way that we engage with the environment, whether we engage with the economy, and of course we engage with each other, our kind of the way that society's made up. And we really need to recognise that the wonderful variability we see around the world today is mirrored by wonderful variability in the past, and be careful that we don't fall back into that kind of stage set of revolutions that I was talking about before, to say, well, all of humanity must have gone through this sequence, because actually when we look at the past, we see all of humanity has not gone through that stage.
And some are still, for example, the landless farmers of Brazil, as an example of people who don't live in a traditional village setting,
right,
even today.
Yeah, and yep. I think that's, we need to really be open to understand, almost imagine a whole set of different life ways that existed in the past, for which we can find analogues, certainly, sometimes amongst modern-day peoples, but also realise that the wonderful thing about the archaeological record, that material record, it tells us about alternative ways for people to engage with the environment. And that is probably a better measure of our past than these very rigid ideas about kind of progress, right, that tend to reflect some of perhaps our own
biases,
right, our own culture rather than the culture of people in the past.
So one of the other things I found that was interesting in what you were doing was trying to see how our ancestors have dealt with changes in their climates. And first of all, I was wondering if there was some common ground there, or were they all variable as well?
Interrelationship between people, climate, and the environment is very, very interesting. And I guess it's understanding the level of engagement, because there are a couple of things. Firstly, climate change, because it's so much on the agenda, it's almost as though it kind of happened with the Industrial Revolution. And before that, the climate was absolutely uniform and never changed at all, right? And of course, when you look at paleoenvironmental studies, that's absolutely not what's happened. The environment's been shifting around at different scales and different places in a whole lot of very interesting ways. And humans throughout their evolutionary history have engaged with those environmental shifts. So we need to be quite clear that, you know, climate change is not something that just happened. Certainly the sort of climate change that's happening, the rapidity that it's happening in recent times has shifted a bit. But environments have always been moving around, and it's very interesting to see the variability in the way that humans have dealt with that, right? Because we have faced environmental challenges before, and humans have found a fantastic array of ways of coping with that. So that's a major research interest for my group.
So what were some of them that you found in the different regions?
We see major shifts in North Africa, for instance, at the end of the last ice age, what we call the Pleistocene, moving into the Holocene. There's some pretty significant shifts in the nature of the Saharan regions, in the Egyptian part of the Sahara certainly, but the Sahara generally. It was considerably wetter in that period immediately after the last ice age. That lasts for quite a significant period of time, and then it begins to dry out, going closer to the hyper-arid desert that we see today. And people had to adapt to those major shifts, and they did so in a number of different ways. Pastoralism, for instance, is one technique that develops. People use domestic plants and animals. There's also a concentration, as I said, on some of these pretty rich river like Nile or Lacustrine, the lake areas like Karoon, and they form places that people return to. And that's very interesting to see how they use those sorts of resources through time.
And then in terms of in New Zealand, could you see any of that?
Well, I guess New Zealand's a fascinating contrast to both the Australian work and the Egyptian work. Firstly, for those of you who may not know, the Polynesian settlement of New Zealand is comparatively recent compared to other areas. Australia's 40, 50,000 years or so old. Of course, the African continent saw the development from our early, very early hominin ancestors through to anatomically modern humans. Polynesia was settled much, much later. Indeed, New Zealand, 700-800 years or so of Polynesian settlement, during which Māori culture developed, right? So the indigenous people of New Zealand. So very much shorter period. But in some ways, there's some very interesting parallels. For instance, the first settlers to New Zealand faced a forested environment. It was almost uniformly forested. Little bit exception, the top of the Alps in southern New Zealand and the volcanoes in the north, but the whole area was forested. The people that came down were people who had domestic plants and some domestic animals. Not so many of the domestic animals made it to New Zealand, but certainly the domestic plants did. So they faced some issues in dealing with this fantastic new environment they'd found. Very, very rich marine resources, as there are today in New Zealand. You can imagine that in the past there would have been even more so. But coping with a different environment outside island Polynesia from where they came was a challenge. So people met that challenge in a number of different ways, established early settlements, and needed to pretty rapidly deal with the fact that they had kumara, which is a Māori name for sweet potato, which they needed to cultivate, which they did fast. So understanding how people interact with those early environments is important. Mobility, it turns out, is also important for New Zealand. We've got very good evidence from the sort of stone sources, the same stone artifact things again, that people were accessing a wide range of sources from all over New Zealand very early in these sites. So obviously people are moving around a great deal. So we come back to this notion, do they establish this almost European vision of a village and kind of surrounding areas, almost in a kind of medieval way? And I think the evidence is pretty clear that they didn't. They had unsurprisingly, yet another take on how to deal with this new environment with domesticated plants and this fantastic marine resource. And they moved around a great deal, as we can see archaeologically.
Right. So in terms of the things that you found, I was reading one article that said that one of the pieces of evidence was dog poop. Is this something that is a common type of evidence that you would analyze?
I guess it's interesting, isn't it? The domestic dog is one of the animals that did make it to New Zealand. But I guess the interesting thing about archaeology is not to concentrate necessarily on single artifacts. So, you know, a lot in the movies you see the archaeologist grabbing the artifact out of some place, right? And this provides the answer to more or less everything, right?
But it's really a lot of puzzle pieces.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what we're looking at is really the mundane material that was left behind by people for a variety of reasons in different contexts. And one of the interesting things is to try and work out why material was left. Certainly, a lot of it is material that's no longer used. It's just not useful particularly. People may have reused it occasionally, but eventually it falls out of the system. Other material is perhaps lost sometimes or abandoned for a variety of different reasons. And to understand the context of the material that we find and the range of material is very important. So certainly dog poo is interesting because it tells you what the dog ate, right? One of the areas that we're very interested in researching is if we can get some paleo DNA, that's some ancient DNA, from the interior of the dog poo. Sort of somewhat bizarrely, you can think of the dog poo as a kind of capsule of material that is relatively well protected from material coming from outside. So, you know, one of the issues about getting ancient DNA is to keep it kind of protected from contamination. And the sort of DNA that we're interested in is not really so much dog DNA. We know it's from dogs, but we're interested in what the dogs ate. And we're particularly interested if the dogs ate, for instance, the sweet potato, the kumara that I mentioned, right? Because finding early evidence of that can be quite difficult. So if they consume that and we can pull that DNA out. We have not managed to achieve that yet, but it's one of our research interests, right?
You got this deep history that most of us don't have, much deeper than historians. It just goes back and back. How do you think that shapes your ideas about humanity?
For me, over the years, what's really struck me is the variability in response of different cultural people at different times in different places. Sure, there's some commonalities about the way people went around things. some of the time, but it's the fascinating diversity. And, you know, there's a lot of attempts, I guess, amongst all of us to go for the big answer. Oh, it's because there's environment change or technological evolution or happenstance. And people are saying, well, that's the reason that such and such a change happened. And this explains the cultural or historical background of a particular people. And, you know, the more you study the deep past, as you point out, and in different regions, the more you realize that that one explanation really isn't going to cut it. It's the wonderful diversity of interaction between people and other people, people in the environment, people in the material culture that they developed. It's that real complexity in the context, in the historical context where we find it, that is the story of humanity, rather than this drive to explain everything by single processes.
Yeah. Now, in modernity, and that we are dealing with climate change and we are dealing with conflict, and probably some similarities as what our ancestors have dealt with, does it give you some sense of how we've evolved, or if we have really evolved, or are we seeing kind of just very minor shifts in what humanity has become?
I think it very much depends what we mean by evolution. And we can define and talk about evolution in a whole lot of different ways, biological evolution, cultural evolution, right? We can use it as a kind of pretty strict Darwinian concept. We can use it as a more general analogy. And I think perhaps the word gets bandied around a lot with those definitions merging into each other. And that's probably not the best to kind of look at. I certainly think that looking at all this diversity, probably the first thing is to understand the diversity, that the way that one group acts is not necessarily the way another group acts. And to get understanding, the more people realize that there's a lot of different ways of approaching problems, and the history of approaching problems leads to a whole lot of different solutions, the better we are. Going in with this, well, the model works in my backyard, therefore it will work in somebody else's backyard, is probably not one that's sustained much by the sort of material I've looked at, right?
Simon Holdaway, great to have you here with us on the Scholar Circle.
It was a pleasure.
Simon Holdaway is a professor of anthropology at the University of Auckland, where he also serves as the head of School of Social Sciences. Simon Holdaway is the author of a number of publications, including A Record in Stone, and his more recent one, Geoarchaeology in Aboriginal Landscape in Semi-Arid Australia. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.